On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats to answer these questions. Is this Thunder defense the best in NBA playoff history? Has Anthony Edwards finally met his match in OKC's swarming wall of defenders? And is it time to stop calling SGA a free throw merchant and start calling him MVP? That and more coming up. Welcome, welcome, welcome. It's The Big Number. We do this every week here at Yahoo Sports. I'm Tom Haberstroh, and right there is my man, Dan Devine. Dan, what's going on, man?
Tom, we're just trying to get the juices flowing. We're trying to fight through adversity. Everybody's playing through something this time of year. I think you can hear by the sounds of our voices. We're both playing through something, but we've reached the conference finals. We are at the final four, but the finish line is within sight. Tom Haberstroh, let's put up some freaking numbers. What is our big number this week?
This week's big number is 90.8.
Beautiful
that is
number.
The Oklahoma City Thunder's defensive rating, meaning how many points they allow per 100 possessions once we adjust for era. 90.8. Dan, if that sounds good, that's because it is. Historically, if you look at the defensive rating, defensive efficiency, points allowed per 100 possessions, and see how much better it is relative to league average. Right now, we're in an offensive crazy, offensive slanted era where it's a little bit easier to score now because of all that spacing. Having what the Oklahoma City Thunder's defensive rating at 102.3 unadjusted, according to Basketball Reference, that is 9.2% better than the league average, which is 112.6. League average, you allow about 112 points every 100 possessions. The Thunder are 10 full points below that mark. And when you look historically, Dan, at the best defenses in postseason history, this is the best one on record. We've never seen among the 140 plus defenses that have played at least 12 postseason games, none of them have been this good relative to league average than the Oklahoma City Thunder. Lou Dort, Kaysen Wall, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, this Chet Holmgren, Isaiah Hartenstein, this defense is vicious. Vicious. And what they did to the Minnesota Timberwolves in game one was evidence of that. That like Anthony Edwards, Julius Randle in the second half and fourth quarter, they basically gave up. They couldn't deal with the Oklahoma City defense anymore. And this is kind of the through line of this postseason is Nikola Jokic, Ja Morant, the Memphis Grizzlies, the Denver Nuggets just could not figure out this defense and it wore them down. And you're seeing it. Alex Caruso, Kaysen Wallace, J-Dub with five steals in game one against the Minnesota Timberwolves. Dan, 20 points allowed in the paint the entire game in game one of the Western Conference Finals. I got to hand it to the audience. A couple people have reached out to me saying you guys were early on this Oklahoma City train. We were there. Episode 3 of this show right here, the big number was about whether this was the greatest defense we've ever seen based on how good they were through 8 games this season. We were like, yo, we haven't seen a defense this good ever at this point in the season, and we pointed out a bunch of reasons why, and they've stuck to it. They sustained it the entire season, the best defense in the NBA, and now we're seeing it. We called this shot 6 months ago. We're seeing it in the postseason where a team like the Minnesota Timberwolves cannot get inside the paint. Anthony Edwards, early at the press conference after the game, I don't know what he was laughing at with Julius Randle. I'm still trying to figure this out.
They were passing back and forth the stat sheet. Maybe it was SGA fouls drawn or SGA free throw. I don't know, something like that. Maybe we'll see.
We'll get to that. Here was Anthony Edwards, the quote, "They clog the paint. That's what they do. Every time I go to the rim, it's like there are four people in the paint." So Anthony Edwards is seeing bodies. Every time he turns the corner and thinks he's got daylight, there's Isaiah Hartenstein or Chet Holmgren at the rim. And then Kaysen Wallace, J-Dub, Alex Caruso, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, they're on top of this dude and he can't get anywhere. So Dan, what did you see from game one that popped to you? We've watched this team all year defend at a high level, but what specifically did you see in game one that was notable in your eyes?
Yeah, the paint points was really leapt off the screen. Just that you had the Wolves. I mean, and the Wolves have plus shooters, right? There's a number of guys who can knock down perimeter shots on that team. Anthony Edwards, his pull-up three-point volume went through the roof this year. And Dante DiVincenzo, Naz Reid, the best version of Julius Randle, yada, yada, yada. But they are not a team where you're like, the sheer volume of three-pointers, 50-plus a game. Like, you don't think of them like you thought of the Celtics, say, or the Cavs in terms of that level of volume. It felt tilted in a way that didn't necessarily indicate the healthiest balance for their offense. And you're so used to seeing Anthony Edwards downhill, like a battering ram, 2 feet in the paint, kick out. And there were some of those drives from him in the game. He had the one where he kind of got deep into the paint and then was able to pivot in midair, find Mike Conley over in the corner. There was a little bit of that kind of downhill penetration. But for the most part, it was boxes and elbows. It was aggressive gap help. It was just bodies. You mentioned it's not just the initial point of attack defender, which the Thunder have fantastic ones of those. It's the two guys that are sucked in, you know, one off the weak side, one over at the nail. It's the guy that you got at least one rim protector behind that. Everywhere you look, there is a dangerous defender in front of between Anthony Edwards and the rim. And that's the challenge that, as you mentioned, Ja Morant and the Memphis Grizzlies faced in the opening round. It's not just how do you beat your guy, it's how do you beat the other three. And especially when those guys are game plan disciplined. They know exactly what they want to do, where they need to be, and what they need to do when they get there. When they are empowered to go and be ball hawks. In that episode you mentioned back in November, you started calling them the Dobermans, like the Scottie Pippen, Michael Jordan Bulls from Phil Jackson back in the 90s. This is what we've seen all year in terms of the way that they generate turnovers, the way that they create deflections, the constant physical pressure they put on you. And we saw all of that in game one. And that's, I think, the thing that stood out to me is just the consistency with which Oklahoma City can bring that kind of defensive pressure. We are at that final four stage where it's like, which of these units and which of these teams, which of these stars do you trust the most? Which of these franchises, what's the way they're put together? What's the superpower that you think is going to carry the most weight? Oklahoma City's defense has been the number one superpower in the NBA all season long. And I think we saw that pay dividends in a huge way in game one.
This is the best defense I've ever seen. It's the best statistically, the best defense the NBA has ever seen. Once you account for scoring error, we just haven't seen a defense do it like this. And it also in spirit, we typically think of the best defenses all time, whether it's KG in the 2008 Celtics and Dikembe Mutombo, Alonzo Mourning, Bill Russell. Like, they have this giant up the middle that is the anchor around everything that they do. And it's usually a veteran who beats up the opponent. This defense doesn't do it like that. They do it in swarms. They do it in with a dozen bodies throughout the game that are excellent defenders, and they're doing it with a swarm of young defenders. We're talking a team that the average age is 24. This is so uncharacteristic. And to get the Minnesota Timberwolves out of everything that they want to do, you mentioned it, how uncharacteristic it was to see them shoot 50 plus three-pointers in this game because they had nowhere to go. They had no daylight. They could not get into the paint. This is the stat that jumped off to me, is that as a result of all of that swarming and smothering Anthony Edwards, Julius Randle, whoever wanted to try to get in the paint, they had no choice but to kick out to shooters. They took more three-pointers as a percentage of their overall offense than they have, not just this season, the Minnesota Timberwolves, but in the franchise history. They took 61% of their shots from beyond the arc, which was the number one rate ever for a Minnesota Timberwolves team, regular season or postseason. And it is also the record for the conference finals. They took 51 three-pointers, conference finals record. We haven't seen 51 plus in the conference finals or in the NBA finals. So this volume, super uncharacteristic. I think they averaged like 51 points in the paint this postseason, and then they just had 20. So completely changed what Minnesota wanted to do. And Anthony Edwards said after the game, they're going to have to look at some tape. And we're going to have to look at some little numbers here. Dan, After the break, we're going to talk about your four little numbers as we do every week here at Yahoo Sports. And we're going to talk about why OKC has the best defense statistically we've ever seen at 90.8 points allowed per 100 possessions adjusted for ERA. All right, Dan, hit me with your first little number.
First little number this week is 15. That's how many Thunder players graded out as positives this season, according to Defensive Estimated Plus Minus, which is Taylor Snar's metric over at his site, Dunks and Threes. 15 dudes on the same team all being at worst, like average or above. That is by far the most of any team in the NBA. The Orlando Magic and Memphis Grizzlies both had 11 players that played for them that were above that. So 15, pretty significant jump. Four of the top 13 players in Defensive Estimated Plus Minus. That's Alex Caruso leading the way, Chet Holmgren 7th, Jalen Williams at 11th, and Isaiah Hartenstein at 13th. This does not include Lou Dort, who is about to make his first all-defensive team, or Cason Wallace, who might have been like the best defender that they had in game one, like went and just took on the Anthony Edwards assignment and was absolutely fantastic on him. The one player in their rotation who grades out as a net negative in this season, at least, was Aaron Wiggins. And he's even still pretty good. Like, at the risk of being very basic and reductive, when you don't play any bad defensive players, you're probably going to be a really good defense, right?
Yeah. And I'll throw this question at you, Dan. Who's their best defender?
Oh, man. It was a column that I was trying to write like later in the season. I didn't wind up getting back to it because it was like, as we were going through the defensive player of the year discussion, like the most value or the metrically inclined, it's like Caruso's at the top of the list, but he'll played like 18 minutes a game and he missed a bunch of games. Right. And both Isaiah Hartenstein and Chet Holmgren were not going to be eligible for the, for the award or for the all defensive teams. And so it's like, well, is it Lou Dort as sort of the representative of them? Yeah. Is Lou Dort even, is he the third best defender on the team? Like, it's so wild to look at it. And then Jalen Williams, who I think it's far enough in the rearview mirror now, but the beginning of the season when they were down both Chet and Hartenstein, he was their center. He was 6'5", jumping center. And the way that they were able to keep their defense at that elite level early in the season was through the pressure that they put on with their swarming, with their switching, with their ability to create, to create turnovers, to create deflections. So they're a team that can play too big and be elite defensively. They can play one big and like a kind of small ball four and be elite defensively. They can play totally small and be elite defensively. And it's because they have that kind of personnel where you just do not find a weak link anywhere you go in that structure.
That's the thing. Like, Evan Mobley won Defensive Player of the Year this year. And I'm watching this this postseason being like, game seven, I'm saying it's Alex Caruso. Game one, I'm saying it's Cason Wallace. In game two, I could probably say Chet Holmgren is the best defender on this team. That's how crazy it is to watch them, is you don't even know on a given night who's going to wreck the opponent and everything they're trying to do. It could be Lou Dort. He could hold Anthony Edwards to 3 of 17 shooting in game two. And you wouldn't be surprised, Dan, because they have so many elite defenders in ways that I don't think we've seen historically this many plus defenders. 15. That's nuts.
Yeah.
That's nuts. And that's like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. One of the reasons why I feel like he is the MVP this season, we'll talk more about this later, is because he's such a good defender. And how many times did you see in that game where, you know, in like the horror movie where like the killer is like hiding in the corner and you see like someone that's like this innocent person just turn the corner and then the camera pans a little bit and the killer's like right behind the person, right, you know, sneaking up behind them. And you're like, no, how many steals did OKC get in that game one where like Anthony Edwards had his back turned and then J-Dub kind of like swung around and unbeknownst to him, just poked the ball away, swiped it, and went the other end. Isaiah Hartenstein was doing it. A lot of times when these offensive guys get flustered by this pocket that they trap you in this web and then someone is just going to leave their guy and steal the ball and go the other end. It's a different guy every time. So you can't even game plan against it because Alex Caruso barely even played in game one. And it was Cason Wallace coming to the rescue and just dominating defensively and just pulling the ball out of everybody. Just an awesome, awesome fleet of defenders by OKC.
Yeah, to your point, 13 steals against 12 turnovers for Oklahoma City in game one, which by my count, and I might be off by one or two here, but I believe that's the 31st time in 94 games since we started the season that they've had more steals than turnovers. So it's not even like we talk about assist to turnover ratio. This is turnovers you're creating versus turnovers that you're giving up. And as we've talked about so many times this season, that possession battle is so gigantic. Oklahoma City, the way that they play defense goes a long way toward tilting that in their advantage, which brings us to our second little number. It's a pretty big one, 847. That's how many live ball turnovers the Oklahoma City Thunder forced during the regular season, according to PvP stats. That not only led the NBA this year, their database goes back to 2000. That's more than any other team in that database going back to 2000. So there have been four other teams going back to 2000, last quarter century, that have gotten over the 800 mark, but they are number one with a bullet. And I think you saw that in game one, 11 of Minnesota's 17 turnovers were live ball turnovers. And Tom, you know, we hear coaches talk about it all the time, like the importance of avoiding live ball turnovers. What makes those so damaging to an offense, and what makes OKC's ability to generate them so vital to its defense?
You know how many fast break points Minnesota had in game one?
Well, they only had 20 points in the paint. I don't know, like maybe like 15?
Zero.
Zero?
Dude, zero fast break points by Minnesota. So your stat about how OKC got 847 live ball turnovers this season, most in the modern era, like, it's easier to score in the open court. Like, steals are also offensive stats, right? And so how many times did J-Dub, you know, steal the ball and go the other way and finish at the rim? There was that great block by Ant in trail. But otherwise, it's just that's how you get great offense oftentimes, is creating those turnovers, live ball turnovers, and going the other way. And in the postseason, those are harder to get. The game slows down. Teams aren't willing to pass the ball as much typically, and they don't leave themselves vulnerable to those leakouts, those open court just attacks by OKC. And when you're talking about why Minnesota just couldn't get anything going offensively, it's because they weren't doing that on their end. They weren't getting those live ball turnovers and converting them. Zero fast break points. I believe that's the first time this postseason that a team has been held to zero fast break points. So, like, that is such a superpower, is to create great great offense from their defense. And in the half court, according to cleaningtheglass.com, OKC was solid. 100 points every 100 plays. 68th percentile. Not elite, but it was getting those live ball turnovers that made them score as many points as they did.
Yeah, and that connected to that, 17 Minnesota turnovers turned into 31 points in game one. Oklahoma City is now averaging 25.3 points per game off turnovers in the playoffs. Again, not only is that the best this season, this postseason, you go back to the play-by-play era starts in the 96-97 season, I believe. It's the most of any team in that entire span going back to 1996. And there's only three other teams that have won a series that even cracked 20. So they're like head and shoulders above any team that got, you know, not even even close to this far with the way that they generate. So yeah, all year long, first in steals, first in deflections, first in loose balls recovered, up near the top of the league in blocks. This is what that leads to. And, you know, on a night where they started really, really rough offensively, even Shea didn't have it going, the defense allowed them to generate enough offense to stay connected. There's a great line in our guy Vinny Goodwill's story off of game one last night. He's going to be with the Western Conference Finals the whole way. Mark Dagno said, "We lost the rounds, but didn't get knocked out." And that defense, it can deliver the knockout punches, but it can also keep you standing. It constitutes their chin. It keeps Oklahoma City standing, even as the other teams throw in haymakers. And it gets us to one of the best haymakers in the league. Our third little number, 7. That's how many times Anthony Edwards drove to the basket in game one, according to Second Spectrum Tracking. We talked about this a little bit up top in terms of the points in the paint issue for Minnesota. Ant averaged 17 drives to the basket per game in rounds one and two, 7 in game one, by far his lowest total of this postseason. Hadn't even been in single digits once before this. And then the absolute waves of defenders just crashing down on him. Starts with Dort, then it's J-Dub, then it's Cason Wallace, then it's Caruso. The getting over screens, the physicality, and which in fairness, a lot of the, you know, there's obviously a lot of Wolves fans and a lot of maybe neutral observers saying, how come they get to play football on defense and then Shea, you breathe on him and he falls down. But the physicality that they play with at the point of attack, and then the way that they load up those gaps, and they're like, we've talked about this with Ant before, like the Mavs did it to him last year. The Lakers did it in game one, they showing him these extra bodies. He's been able to figure it out sometimes successfully. Sometimes he hasn't had a harder time, but the volume of defenders they can throw at him, the quality of defenders they can throw at him, makes it really, really hard for him to get to his spots and get where he wants to go. And it's a gamble, right? It's, if you're going to load up with that kind of help, the bet is we're going to be able to get in and get back out before you can find a shooter. And it's a gamble that the Wolves, or that the Thunder rather, won in game one. It's one they win a lot. And it's one that if Minnesota is going to tilt this, they're going to have to find a way to get Ant a little bit more downhill than seven times a game, you'd imagine.
Yeah, Shea won that matchup for sure in game one. He had 28 drives to Anthony Edwards' seven. 28! Four times as many drives in game one than Anthony Edwards. And, you know, watching that post-game press conference, what was interesting to me, Dan, is when asked about the looks that he was getting and the swarm of defenders, Anthony Edwards didn't say, they're fouling the out of me. He didn't say that. He didn't say, like, the referees need to wake up, or he didn't blame the referees on this one. He said, they're showing four guys in the paint every time I turn the corner. They're closing off the gaps. They're just everywhere. And so there was probably an easy way out of this for him to just, as a 23-year-old, to just blame it on the officiating and blame it on the unfairness of it all. But when you see that gap of 28 drives for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and seven by Anthony Edwards, and these guys see themselves as equals, they're playing two different sports in game one. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is so difficult to guard because he's able to slice through that defense in the tiniest of crannies and get into the paint in ways that Anthony Edwards really struggled to do that against the Oklahoma City defense. I'll just point out, he almost had as many as Chet Holmgren almost had as many as Anthony Edwards in that game, drives. Chet Holmgren had six drives to Anthony Edwards' seven. So that is not the company you want to keep. If you are Anthony Edwards trying to win this series, you want to be head and shoulders above Chet Holmgren in the number of drive penetrations. So that has to improve for Anthony Edwards in game two.
Let's get to our fourth and final little number this week, 23.8%. That's what the Wolves shot on corner threes in game one. You know, you generally think pretty good when you generate a lot of corner threes. They went 5 for 21. The Thunder gave up 21 corner threes and they won in a blowout, which weirdly continues a season-long pattern. Nobody allowed more corner threes during the regular season than the Thunder. They've allowed even more in the playoffs. It was 11.5 per game during the regular season, 11.9 per game through the playoffs. And yet, they were tied for 10th lowest three-point percentage from corner shooters in the regular season. And that's like plummeted even lower during the regular season. Somehow, its opponents are shooting 26.6% from the corners against the Thunder through a dozen playoff games. And so we are a show that talks about the math. And so I have to ask, like, is this just like the wildest variance swing? Like, this is like the coin landing on heads 12 straight games. Is it Mark Daigneau has figured out some way to minimize the value of those short corner shots? Is this the devil magic that we talked about with the Pacers in their late game execution? Downstream effects of like all the ball pressure they put out. Like, try to help me wrap my mind around the fact that the Thunder gave up 21 corner threes to a team that is good at shooting and that they missed more than three quarters of them in a blowout loss. How do we reconcile all this?
I think one thing is that they're exhausted. Like, having to go against this OKC defense, is that maybe it's a case of fatigue, is that those corner threes, normally they're feeling in rhythm. Normally they're feeling with their legs underneath them and they're able to get a good look and take it quickly without feeling like they might get the shot blocked. But I also think like it's a testament to the OKC defense that they're able to close out and give them that kind of the footsteps that you hear that make them, I don't know, a little more timid to take that corner three, or just have, you know, their mechanics off just a little bit, that they don't fully feel comfortable on those corner threes. I do also think that you got to give up something. And if you're going to put four bodies on Anthony Edwards, you're going to give up that corner three. And I think not allowing him getting downhill is more important to them than giving up those corner threes. So it could be devil magic, but they've been doing this all season. And it's something that I think when you watch that game one, I don't know about you, I felt like so many of those were halfway down and they just lipped out. And I was just like, man, that is gut-wrenching if you're a Minnesota fan. Watching, like, Dante DiVincenzo had about three or four of them that it seemed like they were halfway down and then just popped right out. Devil magic, like you said. So I think that's a formula. And Anthony Edwards talked about it after the game, is like, we're gonna continue making the right play, right? And what he's saying there is the whole LeBron James debate is at the end of those games, do you kick out to shooters or do you just go one against four? And Anthony Edwards is saying, you know what? Coach wants me to do this. I think it's the smart play. Kick out to shooters, get the open shots. But three more losses and they're out. So how much more can you just kind of tempt the probability gods and say, you know what? Maybe I just take it to the rack and try to get these foul calls and try to pull a Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and go at some of these dudes and try to get to the free throw line and try to tilt the odds in your favor. Because that can get deflating real fast, is getting these corner three pointers, feeling like that's good offense and not getting the results you want.
Yeah, to have Dante DiVincenzo, Nikhil Alexander-Walker, and Naz Reid combined to go, I'm looking at here, 5 of 28 from three is just gut-wrenching. That's seven more threes just for those three guys than the Thunder took as a team. And, you know, you get any little bit of regression to the mean there in terms of some of those in and outs rattling back in, we might be talking about a very different ball game, which, by the way, was like a two possession game late in the third quarter before everything went completely bonkers. So it feels like the Wolves are a lot farther away today after game one than maybe they felt heading in. But, you know, one of those breaks, two of those breaks go the other way and you're able to open up the offense a little bit more. We could be singing a very different tune after game two heading back to Minneapolis.
Speaking of game two, ahead of game two, Dan, we've got an MVP announcement. We just got word this morning on Wednesday morning that there's finally we're going to anoint the MVP. And I think we can safely say it's going to that number two on Oklahoma City Thunder, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, at 31 points and 9 assists in game one. We're going to talk about that guy who, after the broadcast, Michael Malone for ESPN said, that's the MVP there. That's why he's the MVP. Kind of weird, strange. We'll talk about all that and MVP Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, what it all means, right after the break. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, 31 points, plus 22 in the plus-minus column, 11 of 14 from the free throw line, 10 of 27 shooting from the floor, 9 assists, 3 steals, filled up the stat sheet in game one. And it seems like we are going to get Shai Gilgeous-Alexander anointed as the MVP. The announcement is going to be on Wednesday night ahead of Indiana Knicks. But I can safely assume they're not holding this so that they can award it to Nikola Jokic. Max Cross, who has been tracking the voters publicly, saying, oh, this is my ballot or this is who I voted for. At this point, Max Cross, the MVP tracker, has at 32 first place votes for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander to 15 for Nikola Jokic. So I'm willing to say that it's Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, especially when Michael Malone. How about that? Michael Malone saying after the game, that's why he's the MVP, suggesting that he's already won it or he's got some word, when he was just coaching Nikola Jokic and went multiple times talking about why it's asinine to not give the MVP to Jokic. But hey, you know what? job's a little bit different.
Yes, it is. I love too that it was like the one of the first things we get from Michael Malone was like detailed tape breakdown of Anthony Edwards against help defense. And then about an hour later, it's like, here's the bomb that I throw for aggregation. It's like, you're learning the ecosystem well, coach. Nicely done. Well played.
He was good. I really liked actually. Yeah. He was actually one of the hardest things to do in media is the stand up, is just standing by yourself with your earpiece and having to do a live report courtside, and just hearing your producer or hearing the host talk to you. It's a very lonely experience. And he brought a lot of energy. I loved what he did. Good analysis, and it seemed like he's really good at this. But of course, we'll see if he wants to do this long term. But besides the point. Point is, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is probably going to be named the MVP. He's the MVP in my book. He is by far the scoring leader this season, 32.7 points per game. Giannis was at like 30.4, so he had like over 2-point lead in the scoring column. And then when you look at the plus minus, the steals, the assist to turnover ratio, the leadership, I think is a big part of this. When you hear Mark Daigneault talk about Shai Gilgeous-Alexander as an emotional temperament, what he did in the first half compared to the second half in that game, when Anthony Edwards is so frustrated with this dude that he's throwing the ball at him when he's laying on the ground, putting his hands up, and he's trying to get all these foul calls, and people are saying, Dan, like free throw merchant, like this foul merchant. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, our favorite Doris Burke, is talking on the broadcast and bringing up that NBA Twitter believes he's a foul merchant, free throw merchant. And I understand why people are frustrated with all the foul calls that he gets, because I think it's unusual the way that he gets these calls. You know, he is so laterally unpredictable. Jaden McDaniels fouled out in this game one, and a couple of those were phantom fouls, but that's true for every superstar in the NBA. Jokic benefits from the whistle. Doncic benefits from the whistle. LeBron does. Every MVP candidate in the NBA will get one or two calls a game that you're like, did he really foul him there? So, Dan, do you have any thoughts on like how you'll look back on this MVP race this season and what this will mean for the NBA if Shai Gilgeous-Alexander wins it for the Oklahoma City Thunder this season?
Well, to me, and one of the challenges with MVP voting, and I do have a ballot and I did vote for Shai over Jokic in second place. One of the challenges is balancing sort of the, whatever, sober-minded statistical analysis with, I don't think that narrative is a dirty word. I think storytelling is a really important part of our business and also of what our jobs are and what we do. To me, the Thunder were the story of this season. Their arrival and ascent to all-time historically great team status, and that the driver of that, literally and figuratively, is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Like, they do not. Yes, you can make the argument that this team, he has the better supporting cast around him, and Jokic has to do a heavier carry job, and so on and so forth. And like, the reasonable people can have reasonable disagreements about these sorts of things. I suspect what we're going to wind up, we're recording this before the announcement, is you'll get SGA 1 and Jokic 2, and that'll be inverted on a bunch of ballots, but not on enough. And that's my guess for how this will play out. But everything about how Oklahoma City plays with the way that they structured the team to be a five out team with Chet as the big, the shooter, the drive and kick, the guard screening actions, everything that kind of got the ball rolling for Oklahoma City, all of that flows out from Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. You built the race car for this driver. And like, if you didn't have him, if he wasn't able to, and hadn't shown the capacity to be this kind of difference maker, where even if the free throw that discussion is going to be an important one, and it's going to be an annoying one, but it's also going to be a relevant one. And it's what we got to get kind of like saddle up for. You strip out the free throws from Shai, Jokic, Ant, Giannis, whatever, Shai still leads all scorers by several hundred points. Like, it's in terms of the over the course of the full season. So this is not purely unethical hoops. There's more to it than that. And you combine that with, as you mentioned, the fact that he is a plus, a positive contributor to what is the best defense we've ever seen by statistical measurements and by a variety of eye tests, that he's not like, he's the, might be the weaker link on the unit, but he's not a pigeon to get picked on, right? And so, and the fact that he generates those steals, he generates blocks from the guard position. And then you like zoom out and it's 35-5, 50%+ shooting with the steals and the blocks. And you're talking about Michael Jordan territory, like the in terms of production, not just from the guard spot, from anybody hitting those numbers. It's Jordan and it's SGA. And on a 68 win team that goes down as one of the most dominant regular season teams we've ever seen and finished 18 wins ahead of Jokic's Nuggets. So when I think back at it, when I review the tape on this years down the line, I don't think I'm going to come away from it feeling like I missed out on something or I blew it or I you know, there's a great shame and a dishonorable, you know, injustice done. Jokic is a completely worthwhile selection at number one, like 30-point triple-double on historic efficiency. Unbelievable the degree to which he elevates that offense and kept everything steady amid all the turmoil around him. But I think to that point, arguing that Shea doesn't deserve it, I think would be ridiculous. You could argue that Jokic deserves it more, and that's fine by me. But I think arguing that SGA would not be a deserving winner would be, you know, a bridge too far.
Yeah, I think some people look at this and say, this is Derrick Rose 2011, that it's all about story and narrative, not actual production, that this is an all-time defense and he's not the head of the snake defensively. So he's getting the benefit of a ridiculous defense. And because he scores yay points, he's the MVP. I disagree with that. It is not D Rose. This is not a storyline, narrative, whatever you want to call it. MVP. Advanced metrics. He leads all players in estimated wins on estimated plus minus dunksandthrees.com. He leads all players in win shares. He leads all players in plus minus. Listen to this. He had plus 918 this season, and Jokic was second at plus 594. Plus 918 and plus 594. That is insane. That's over 300 points more than the next highest guy in the NBA in that category. Just, he's a winning player. And as we see in this postseason, he's a winner. This free throw merchant thing is driving me crazy because do you have any times this postseason that Shea Gilgeous-Alexander has double-digit free throw attempts in consecutive games? How many times he's done it, like, in repeat games?
Twice.
He's played 12 games. So like how many times has he had back-to-back games?
Twice. I'm not looking at his box scores now. Let's say twice.
It's zero. Okay. It's zero. Mm. I'm going to read you his free throw totals in this postseason. 12, 8, 6, 12, 5, 15, 15, 10, 12, 10. That's actually not him. That's KD in 2019. Kobe Bryant, 10, 23, 12, 17, 10, 17, 17 in 2008. That's seven straight with double digit free throw attempts. 10, 14, 18, 9, 25, 21. Dwayne Wade, 2006. 27, 13, 11, 4, 13, 28, 15, 12, 13, 11, 15, 17, 11, 12. That is a 25-year-old guard by the name of Michael Jordan.
Mm.
All right, so Shea Gilgeous-Alexander hasn't had double-digit free throw attempts in back-to-back games, but surely his free throw attempts for foul merchant, free throw merchant, whatever you want to call him, surely his total free throw attempts is extreme and ridiculous for an MVP candidate. So let's do it. Shea Gilgeous-Alexander averaging a little over 9 free throw attempts per game this postseason, 110 free throw attempts in 12 games. So where do you think that ranks? How many times have we seen a guy have at least 110 free throw attempts in a 12-game span, single postseason all time? Would you say like top 50 players?
I was even going to say higher. I was maybe like top 20. I mean, like, that's a lot of free throws in a short span.
Shai Gilgeous-Alexander this postseason, Dan. You're crying. This is so ridiculous.
It's so ridiculous. I'm crying.
His 110 free throw attempts ranks 406th all time for the highest number of free throw attempts in any 12-game span. It's not even top 400, Dan.
That's incredible. So I was way off when I said top 20. That was way off.
400 times we've seen guys take more free throws in a 12-game span than what we're seeing with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Just to entertain you some more here, Michael Jordan's highest over a 12-game span is not 120 or 130 or 140. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, 110. Michael Jordan is at 179. LeBron, 174. Jerry West, 155. Oscar, 154. Again, Shai, right now, free throw merchant, 110 over a 12-game span. Oscar had 154. Giannis, 145. Hakeem, 145. Tim Duncan, 140. Kobe, 139. D. Wade, 137. Rick Barry, Dirk, Kawhi, Larry, James Harden, Dominique, Melo, Manu Ginobili, 122 wow. over a 12-game span. And Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is at 110. Paul Pierce, 122. Jimmy Butler, Allen Iverson, Jalen Brunson, Russell Westbrook, Joe Fulks.
Jumping Joe Fulks.
My guy. 113 free throw attempts every in a 12-game span. Gail Goodrich, a free throw merchant for sure. Gail Goodrich, Luka Doncic, Paul George, Trae Young, Earl Monroe, all have had more free throw attempts in a 12-game span in a postseason run. I rest my case.
This, it feels like maybe what we're learning is high volume ball handlers, high volume shot creators, high volume drivers often generate a lot of free throw attempts, and that maybe it's not necessarily an indication of a lack of, ethics or a recent cooking of the game, or a product that is stepped on and, marginalized or brutalized. Maybe it's just that this kind of thing happens sometimes.
If you're really good at basketball and scoring, you're going to get these calls. That's not to say that it's perfect. The officiating in that game, there were a couple calls that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and there was a couple calls the other way that I thought was not a foul, or the guy was in defensive position and it was a legal defensive play. But to argue that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is some sort of exception to the rule, that he's getting preferential treatment from the officials, is a contradictory stance compared to all the great scorers in NBA history. They've had way more free throws and been way more dependent on free throws than this guy, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. 406th highest number of free throws in postseason history over a 12-game span. And we're going to probably hear some free throw merchant chants in Minnesota. Wouldn't be surprised if that happens for the guy that is not even top 400 in most free throws over a 12-game span. Hasn't even done it in double-digit free throws in multiple games. I think people are just looking for something to hate on for these OKC Thunder, like 60-plus win team, that there's like they're young. They don't have any bullies on their team. Like, you can maybe say that Lu Dort is kind of like a Matthew Dellavedova, Dylan Brooks, like got some Marcus Smart in him. But guess what? Every champion, every team that is in the title contention has one of those guys or multiple of those guys. OKC is no different.
What I will remember from this MVP debate season, whatever, is not one guy got an unfair advantage because of how many free throws he generated. What I will remember is best player on best team, incredible individual statistical argument for incredible on-court impact, incredible elevation of a franchise from where it had been like in the real doldrums a handful of years ago to now being set up to be not just the class of the NBA this year, but moving forward. That this will, what I will remember years on the line is like, this is the arrival of a new global superstar. This is an ascent reaching its apex. And We might be, you know, seven more wins away from Shai Gilgeous-Alexander being at the top of that mountain. I think that's what I will remember moving forward. It still remains to be seen how the series and how the finals play out. But that's what it feels like to me. It will not be a, like, there is a miscarriage of justice. It will be like, we have introduced a new megastar into the conversation. And at a time where it feels like there is a bit of a changing of the guard in the NBA, that's what I will remember this season as. And I hope that that's what we wind up taking away from this, as opposed to a reason to tear down one guy or another. It's pretty cool that we get to elevate another one into that space too. That's what I think.
Yeah, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander winning the MVP this season feels more like Steph Curry in 2015, when it was like, he has arrived and this Golden State Warriors team might be a dynasty in the making. And sure enough, they won a whole bunch of titles. And I feel like that is much closer to what we're seeing with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander than it is a D Rose one-off from 2011. I think Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is more than deserving. And also, I think this is the start, not the end point, for OKC and all of those picks, how young they are. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, 26 years old, he's entering his prime. And he's going to be fending off Wemby, Anthony Edwards. In this series, Anthony Edwards, he's going to be fending him off. But if it is indeed Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and we're going to have to redo this entire segment if it turns out that it is not him, and we're going to do the same thing for Jokic, we'll do a redo, Control X, Command X, and try to delete that and paste something else in there. But I think this is Shai, and deserving congrats to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and we'll see what Anthony Edwards has to say about it in game two. Dan, this was really fun to do, talking about a small market team, just like we did last week with the Indiana Pacers. Thanks to all the fans who gave a shout out to us and left a lot of comments in the below our YouTube video. Just really cool to read all the Pacers fans getting excited about their team, and what very worthy discussion about how good that team is. So if you haven't watched last week's episode on the Indiana Pacers being the second best team in the NBA since January 1st and what goes into that, and I did this like weird passers thing where I called them the Indiana Passers. Go listen to that. Go rate us 5 stars. I want to give a shout out to Dan for powering through the coughs. We had some coughitis in this one, so thank you for staying with us. Dan, hope you feel better. We certainly need to get our sleep and our nutrients and try to get some rest here in time, but also want to give a shout out to Stone and Mike and yes, the entire team that has bared with us this season, and we're peaking at the right time here. Thank you for working so hard behind the scenes to make this podcast a reality, and the show on YouTube. So please watch The Big Number on YouTube, hit that subscribe button wherever you get your podcast, leave us a rating, and please 5 stars and tell your friends. We'll be back next week with another episode of The Big Number. Until then, be safe and get some cough drops, everybody, including you, Dan, please.